I'll bet if you ask most people to list just on the spot, if we were to have you do this again in a small conversation with your neighbor, what's the most amazing standout events or event in the Bible? I'll bet most people would say some version of Jesus raising from the dead. You'd probably find, without exception, it's in the top three of standout miracles in the Bible. Fair enough? So I want you to think, in fact, I want you to shout out right where you're seated, other things that would be on your list, other miracles that for you are just the kind of miracle that you would not forget, nor would you likely stop talking about. What are some of those miracles? I'm sorry? Parting the Red Sea, that's on my list too. Serious? It's got to be. Yeah, 5,000 and then 4,000, right? So there's two different events there, but in both cases, you'd have gone, I just can't believe that. I was one of the people, my tummy was filled. I was full, satisfied. And there, we didn't have much to work with. What's that? Wow, that's huge, isn't it? You're created in the image of God, Imago Dei. Somebody else? Lazarus, so another resurrection, right? So I love to be able to see. And if I had been born unable to see, I think that, and if I had been there, especially if I was the man that was given sight, I would have never stopped talking about it. And I probably would have irritated people around me like, oh, did you see that? And they're like, yeah, what's the deal, you know? And because it would be so stunning to actually see. Or the lame man. We would call it a paralytic, a person that can't walk. I have a neighbor that's a quadriplegic. Imagine him and another neighbor that's stricken by polio. I've never known them to walk. And I imagine if Jesus walked, came up Luke Lane and touched them and they could walk and I saw it, it would amaze me. Of course, I started with the resurrection of Jesus. If you were there, you would have never been the same. If you weren't, you would likely have been somewhat incredulous, maybe doubtful, if not outright skeptical. How could that have happened? By the way, I don't know if you knew this, but there's some 9 stories of dead people coming back to life in the Bible. Did you know that? There's 9 stories. I of course, Jesus stands out as the most important and one we talk about because it was not only planned, but its purpose was revealed. Jesus died for me. And then he rose again to conquer life's greatest enemy, death. All right, so we know that, but somebody mentioned Lazarus, very dear friend of Jesus, brother to Mary and Martha, and he dies, and he'd been in the tomb, we're told, for several days, and then Jesus raises him from the dead. My list is incomplete, but I can't be a preacher and not remember Eutychus. Acts 20, he's sitting on a windowsill in the 3rd floor of a building listening to a very long sermon by the Apostle Paul. And he dozes off and falls and dies. And now would not be an appropriate time to comment about long sermons, okay? Just for the record, it stands out to me because it's kind of significant. The story, of course, of Elijah, who raised the son of a widow in Zarephath up in the north. We covered that in our last studies together of Elijah. But we come today to a story that's captured in 2 Kings 4 of yet another child who dies. And he's the son, the only child of a Shunammite couple. 2 Kings chapter 4 is page 254 if you're using the Bible that's near you. There's a song we're going to sing on the other side of my message today, and it's what my sermon title was drawn from. You can count on God. Listen to these words. In any circumstance, any age, it's not just a kid's song, so don't make the mistake of saying, well, that was cute. It's profoundly filled with theology and truth. I can count on God through anything, the lyrics go. I can count on God for what I need. I can count on God because he's my creator, my provider, my protector, savior, and king. And then there's some hand motions that you're free to do if you feel like it. Whoa, you know, it's really cute, that part of it. But the theology, the truth, works if you're a senior adult, lonely, a widow, widower, an unemployed person, someone who just heard terrible news from the doctor. Have I touched most of us in this room? I was struck this morning when I walked in here how many people I said hello to and who said in reply with a somewhat guarded response, hi. They weren't mad at me. It's not like they didn't like my outfit or something. It's something was up. Something happened today or yesterday or since we last talked. You can count on God. That's the message of today's story. Now, there's a backstory that goes all the way back to when Elijah had a showdown on a mountain called Carmel, Mount Carmel. I want to say for some reason Mount Carmel, which of course is Carmel by the sea in California, and it's a really cool place to golf, I'm told. But anyway, Mount Carmel is on the coast, and it's a special place. It goes down in history as the place when God dominated the false gods of Baal and Asherah. 850 prophets in one day, in one hour, were eliminated, removed from the planet, quit breathing the air of this earth because they were dragging people down in the wrong direction, enticing them to follow a false god. So that place was special. It's also a special place because that's where Elijah called for an end to the drought that had ravished the land and resulted in a terrible famine for 3.5 years. And so Mount Carmel goes down as a really special place. So not surprising, Elisha found his way to Mount Carmel often. But he was I'm going to use the word itinerant prophet. That is, he moved around. He didn't just stay in Carmel and sort of do his work as a prophet from far away. He would travel from Carmel to the north all the way down to the south tip, the southern tip of the Dead Sea. And if you were to see a map of this, it's enough land that you need stopping places along the way. And Shunem is one of those towns. If you were to follow a map from Carmel, go due east and slightly south, not far from Jezreel, which is the town named after Ahab's evil wife, Jezebel, you would come to a place, agricultural place, known as Shunem. And it's where this couple lives, the Shunammite couple. And here's where the prophet Elijah's path crosses with this woman. One day, Elisha, verse 8 of 2 Kings 4. Elisha went to Shunem, and a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he came by, he stopped there to eat. So this is a regular, repeated kind of a thing. Did I mention it's 25 miles away from Mount Carmel? So, an appropriate stopping point. She said to her husband, I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room for him on the roof, which was sort of a balcony-ish place in an ancient home. Let's make a place for him on the roof and put in it a bed and a table, a chair and a lamp. And then he can stay there whenever he comes to us. That is, when he's traveling back and forth, he can stop and stay, catch his breath, be refreshed. So let's just stop for a second and gather up what we know. She's a wealthy woman, which almost certainly means she married a wealthy man. We're never told his name. We do learn later in the story he was old, which might play into the fact that he was incapable, or they as a couple were incapable of conceiving children, which is a very relevant and important point in this story. So she's a wealthy, we're told she had much means, or she was well-to-do. Notice secondly, she was warm, hospitable, we would say. In verses 8 and verse 10 that we just read, tells us that she was interested in reaching out and providing a place of solace for the prophet as he traveled along. And she was wise, I would call it, spiritually alert enough to say, I know this man is a holy man of God. Now, Elisha, how did he feel about all this? Well, as you might feel, very grateful for a place to stay, to stop, be refreshed. And he was grateful for a furnished flat, so much so that he sought to reach out to this couple and say, what can I do for, how can I bless you? You've been a big blessing to me, and I want to bless you. Which is where the story picks up some speed. So verse 11, one day when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, you'll hear his name come up often, call the Shunammite, this woman. So he called her, and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, tell her, you have gone to all this trouble for us. Now, what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf? He's suggesting some possibilities to a king. Or to the commander of the army. Are you in some kind of trouble? Can I mitigate or mediate that trouble? She replied, I have a home among my people. In other words, I'm well suited. I'm well situated. What can be done for her? Elisha asked. Gehazi says, she has no son and her husband is old. Okay. So Elijah says, then call her. So he called her, and she stood in the doorway. About this time next year, Elisha said, you will have a son in your arms. Now, stop for a moment. You would expect that to be glorious news, wouldn't you? You're incapable of having children. You're likely not to have them, humanly speaking. But her response is very different than that. No, my Lord, she objected. Please, man of God, don't mislead your servant. So let's stop for a moment. Prophet knows that this woman is childless. In the ancient world, writes one observer, next to being widowed, childlessness was probably the worst fate that could befall a woman. End quote. Infertility has always been, not just in ancient times, but in present times, a source of great personal pain. Ask an infertile couple, and it's likely that they will tear up telling you, this has been a really hard road. And in the ancient world, it got worse than that because it was widely believed in the 9th century BC thereabouts that infertility was in fact a curse, perhaps even a sign of divine judgment. Because normal people have babies when they want them. What's wrong with you and why are you abnormal? The conclusion, albeit false in that day, and some even hold on to this view today, is that something's wrong with you and God. Where did you sin? Where's your faith? That sort of thinking. It was very strong in that day. Proverbs 13:12. May not be a proverb that you've ever heard, but when I quote it, I hope you'll never forget it. It's a proverb I put to memory years ago when Debbie and I were 5.5 years infertile. Okay? It says, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but desire fulfilled is the tree of life. Every month you hope for, we're pregnant. And every month it doesn't happen, your hopes are dashed. Hope deferred, writes Proverbs, makes the heart sick. So it's not surprising at all to the reader that she would resist. I'm done with that roller coaster ride, is kind of what's behind her words here. I can't live through that anymore. I've put that to rest. I've given up the hope. Infertile couples do that. That's what you come to. And you say, okay, we're not going to have children. Let's go buy a fast sports car. When we were days from doing that when we conceived. Seriously. So it explains why she says, please don't give me this false hope. No, 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 no. Don't mislead me. My heart can't take it. That's what's behind those words. But as predicted, she conceives, verse 17, becomes pregnant, and the next year, about that same time, she gives birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. Now, desire fulfilled is the tree of life. You've got to imagine when you read those words, there's a smile that will not leave her face. Pinch me, somebody. I can't believe I'm a dad. I can't believe I'm a mom. I wrote this off. I was on to other things. You see the humanness here? And I've got a baby in my arms. But her joy was short-lived, because what happens next happens fast, much too fast for any parent that's celebrating a long-awaited birth. The child grew, verse 18, and one day went out to his father, who was working in the field with the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. And the father told a servant, carry him quickly to his mother. And after the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap, being rocked by her until noon. And then he died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door and went out. We don't know how old her son was at this point. Done a lot of sort of conjecture. I'm guessing preschool is best I could come up with, mostly because he was not too big to be on her lap as she held him to his last breath. We don't know how he died. My head, that's the evidence we get, and that those symptoms are consistent with any number of things. He's out in the field with his father in the harvest, so perhaps it's sunstroke or heat stroke of some kind, or maybe an aneurysm. Those would all be consistent with such an outcry, my head, my head. But we do know he's dead. He dies. And devastated, this grief-stricken woman almost didn't need to think about her next move. She makes immediate plans to go find the prophet Elisha and Gehazi, his assistant, who were not at the house at that time. Remember, she lays her deceased son on his bed. And so she puts together this plan. Let's read it together and see what we can learn. She calls her husband, says to him, please send one of your servants and a donkey. Send me one of your servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. Why go to him today? He said. It's not the new moon or the Sabbath. That's all right, she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on, don't slow down for me unless I tell you. That's important because this road was not a smooth highway. This would be a brutal journey for her. Don't stop. Don't talk to anybody on the way. Move quickly. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, perhaps suspecting something at this point. Are you all right? Makes no sense. I saw the cloud of dust as you were making your way quickly west to Carmel. And are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your son all right? And notice her answer to Gehazi. Yes, everything's fine. as though to dismiss his questions because she's not going to play this little, sort of comfortable conversation game. She's going right past him to the prophet himself. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, verse 27 tells us, she took hold of his feet, that is, she collapsed at his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away. That's not proper to do, was his thinking. But the man of God said, leave her alone. Look at his insight. She's in bitter distress. But the Lord has hidden from me and not told me why. I'm not exactly sure. I had a hunch. I asked my questions. And then this phenomenal, these words that come from a mother that almost now regrets being a mother. Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes? Don't get me excited about something that I've pretty much settled. Why? We're told she was in bitter distress and grief. May I suggest, too, outrage. This feels cruel. This isn't fair. It's impossible to imagine the depth of her pain and loss. It's not the prophet's plan either. He tried to honor her, remember? That's what this was all about. I want to bless you. You've been a blessing to me. But his kindness felt probably at this time to this dear woman like a kick in the gut. I don't want you to miss what happens next, because in my judgment, it's how you handle this kind of crisis. You may not have this kind of experience in your life and may never have it. But it's my belief that if God believes that he can trust you to deliver the right kind of care to somebody with this kind of need, he will bring them to you. Notice first he sends Gehazi with his staff, which was a sign of authority. He sends him in haste, verse 29 tells us. Tuck your cloak in your belt, which is sort of throwback to Elijah. Remember when he left Carmel and ran quickly? It's a, you're going to move fast, so don't have anything encumbering your cadence. Tuck your cloak in your belt, take my staff in your hand and run. Don't greet anyone you meet, and if anyone greets you, don't answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face. But the child's mother said, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he got up and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound and no response. He was still dead. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him, the boy has not awakened. the staff, I'm not prepared to tell you I know exactly what that was all about. I just think it has to do with the authority represented by the staff of a prophet, a man of God. And to go and place that there was to declare some sort of authority over this situation is the best I can come up with. It didn't work. Whatever, if it was intended to bring the child back to life, it didn't happen. And so, first thing is the action I want you to see. He moved quickly in the situation. It called for a fast response. Gehazi carried that out. But notice second, he stayed with the woman, and I want you to look closely what he didn't say. Because not one sentence is recorded here of conversation between he and she for 25 miles. What's that about? I'd raise a question. Do you know how it feels when the bottom falls out in your life and somebody comes alongside you and puts their arm around you and cries with you but says nothing. I do. And so did Joe Bailey. He was the father of four sons, three of whom died of a very strange and mysterious genetic disorder. His one surviving son I knew. And he wrote a book telling about that long journey of grief. It was first titled A View from a Hearse. And then it was retitled The Last Things People Talk About. I was sitting, torn by grief, at the death of yet another son. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly. He said things I knew were true. I was unmoved, except to wish he'd go away. And he finally did. Another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask me leading questions. He just sat. He sat with me for an hour or more and listened when I said something, answered briefly, prayed softly, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hated to see him go. Walking on that long road, I suspect part of the ministry of this prophet, unlike his normal ministry, which was to proclaim, think of what a prophet does, declare, speak. By my best guess, he was silent. And what was already a long journey must have seemed 10 times as long. Upon arriving, without a word, he takes part in a very rare, only nine, as I mentioned earlier, resurrection event. Let's not miss it together. Verse 33. He went in and shut the door on the two of them and prayed, he now and this deceased child. He prayed to the Lord, then got up, got on the bed and laid on the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands, as he stretched himself out on him, again presuming to somehow depict some complete authority over every part of this lifeless person. The boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room. Then he got on the bed and stretched out once more, just the same way, and the boy sneezed seven times and opened his eyes. There's a lot of mystery in this story. I have no idea except seven's a perfect number. Maybe his efforts were perfectly successful. I don't even know. But he's alive. And Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. And he did. And when she came, he said, take your son. She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. There is no way human language could convey the kind of stunning triumph of this moment. Like with any of the other dead people coming back to life, it's so stunning. It's words just sort of fall short in an attempt to capture what's truly happened here. My message today is appropriately titled, You Can Count on God. I doubt any words better describe Elisha in this moment. What if the boy stays dead? Have you thought of that? What if he goes in there and does everything that he was doing and the boy stays dead? What if the woman didn't just break at his feet sobbing for relief but became furious? What if word spread that God let this woman's only son die and somehow the man of God, the prophet of God, was incapable of raising him to life? Here's what this whole story is about. God's plan. It's about God's plan. His plan is perfect. He works the details out of his plan perfectly. Now I know you can do all things, and no plan of yours can be thwarted, was the conclusion Job came to in chapter 42 of the longest odyssey in the Bible. Now I know that you can do all things, and no plan of yours can be thwarted. That's what we're reading here. It's all about God's plan. His plan is perfect. He works the details out of his plan perfectly. I was discussing with someone this week here at Grace Point the meaning of Romans 8:28. Our conversation circled around some things that are happening in this person's life that just seem so in conflict with Romans 8:28, which reads, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose." So I explained my understanding of that verse to this person this way. In all things, good or bad, happy or sad, life or death, God is working to bring about good in the lives of people who love him and have a relationship with him. I read these words that explain a practical touch point to this story. I'd like to share them with you. Who hasn't prayed for God to heal someone, but the person nevertheless died? I raised my hand. I was reading that, and I thought, that's my whole career. I'm like, in baseball, I'm 0 for how many times at the plate, because I prayed that prayer and prayed that prayer, and they still leave this life. They die. Or who hasn't implored God for money to come in, but it never did? And people tell you God will provide for your needs, but it didn't come in. Does that mean God has failed us? Certainly not. It means that he has purposes that we don't know and perhaps cannot know. It's in your outline, but Isaiah 55 gets that. My ways are not your ways, neither are your ways my ways. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so far removed are God's ways from our ways. It means we're human and we scratch to understand, but sometimes even in squinting, we don't see it. We don't get it. We find ourselves going, what is going on? Still quoting. Our challenge is to trust that whatever he gives us, be it life or death, health or illness, riches or poverty, whatever he gives us, pleasure or pain, somehow figures into his plan. And it is his plan, not ours. He assures us that our part, along with everyone else's, is all working together for good, but he has not chosen to reveal the entirety of what he's up to, not yet, anyway. Is that your story like it's my story? Unbelievable. In coming weeks, we're going to find our way to chapter 8, and you'll find yet further purpose in this son being resurrected. Because, in fact, God uses his resurrection to restore a situation that was muddled and messy to this Shunammite woman. What a plan! You couldn't know it at this moment. What a God! A God you can count on. That's what I'm saying this morning. I want to encourage you to take away from this talk this truth. Whatever happens in your life, good or bad, you can count on God to work through it. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. And let's take a moment to be honest about real life. Because real life causes every person in this place to understand examples from our own situation where we sometimes with a fist clenched shake our hand and fist at God and say, God, what are you doing? If we're honest, we'll admit that that's mostly because we don't get what you're doing, God. We don't know what you're up to. But in all those things, the things that are obvious and easy, or the things that are fuzzy and confusing, we have a God that says, I'm at work, and I'm working my plan, my purpose. If you're in the dark valley right now of whatever that looks like, can I encourage you with Ezekiel's words? Jeremiah the prophet said something similar as well. He says, Ah, sovereign Lord, creator of heaven and earth. Covers it all, doesn't it? Nothing is too difficult for you. Not even what you're going through right now. So God, we come to you as people that recognize we are finite and you are not. And you are awesome, which sometimes leaves us in awe and sometimes feels awful because we don't get our situation. We don't understand what we're going through. But as this truth is presented today from your word, we know we can count on you, God. Strengthen our struggling faith with that truth. Cause it to be like a blanket of peace over our hearts. So that when people we work with or live with ask us, given what you're going through, what explains your peace? We get to tell them, you know, God's got a plan. I don't quite get it, but God does. And I trust him because God's good. I want to be someone that is so confident in counting on you, God, that I freely tell people about that. As we sing now that truth in this song, let it inspire you when you leave here to tell people about it.